In a not-so-startling announcement that makes the latter story relevant to today's focus on Asia, the Chinese government has released a statement congratulating the new pope on his election and subsequently expressing the hope that the Vatican will refrain from meddling in China's internal affairs, namely in the way that the communist government treats Chinese Catholics. Beijing officials emphasize the need to respect Chinese sovereignty in its policies towards religious sects within the country, dismissing any notion of a greater religious responsibility. The Chinese government has long been criticized for its persecution of religion, specifically Christianity. The Catholic news agency reported that incidences of Christian oppression and anti-religious government action has increased 42% from 2011 to 2012. The communist Chinese government is extremely wary of any sort of outward allegiance by its people, and the Chinese populace is supposed to be dedicated to and commanded by the Communist Party alone. When the People's Republic of China was founded in 1949, all religious practices were mandated to be overseen by the State Administration for Religious Affairs. Catholics were under the jurisdiction of the Chinese Catholic Patriotic Association, the CPA, and the bishops were appointed by the state. The government did not accept interference by the Vatican.
However, most of China's 12 million practicing Catholics resent the omission of the papacy from nationally sanctioned Catholicism and therefore choose to practice illicitly in small home churches as opposed to attending one of the 6,000 national Catholic churches in China. Many bishops insist on acknowledging the primacy of the Holy See and therefore remain officially unordained and must preach in secret. Some of these priests have disappeared or been forcefully removed from their position by the Chinese government, actions which are condemned as oppression of religious minority. In 2005, Pope Benedict XVI attempted to reconciliate, with the People's Republic of China by inviting two state-appointed bishops and two underground bishops to visit Vatican City, but they were denied the right to leave the country by the Chinese government. Just last year, in April of 2012, the Holy See Press Office released a statement concerning the state of affairs between the Vatican and China, in which the papacy praised Catholics in China for the continuing faith and urged them to somehow make compatible the promulgation of the Lord's will and the perpetuation of national and cultural values and loyalties.
Still, statistics show that the Chinese government is still cracking down on religious dissent. According to China Aid, a Christian human rights organization dedicated to promoting religious freedom in China, the number of people arrested and sentenced for the illegal practice of Christianity more than doubled from 2011 in 2012. Though concrete numbers are hard to come by due to the opaque nature of the Chinese government and judiciary, there is no doubt that there remains a climate of extreme hostility towards Chinese Catholics, who chose to practice outside the limits of the Chinese Catholic Patriotic Association, as evidenced by Chinese antagonism towards the Holy See. The Chinese government is also opposed to the diplomatic ties between the Vatican and Taiwan, as China still views Taiwan not as an independent nation, but as a dissident Chinese island. The Vatican has stated its willingness to remove its presence from Taiwan to China if the latter promises tolerance towards all Catholics, but China has not agreed to this term.
Well, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that China will ever become religiously tolerant in its, as a communist state?
Oh, gosh. The idea of communism is that all religion is poison, essentially. So.
Yeah.
I wouldn't really know.
Karl Marx, religion is the opium of the people.
Well, exactly, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think that for sure the two are definitely incompatible. And especially when you have an autocratic state like they do in China, they really don't want people's loyalties residing outside of the state, which is why they're so antagonistic towards the Vatican and the Holy See. Still, I don't know. I mean, the thing is that in the number of Catholics in China, I don't think that they're decreasing. In fact, there are many signs to show that Catholic populations around the world, especially in places like Mexico, are growing, if anything. I mean, perhaps they're a bit more secular than they used to be, but faith, I don't think, is any lessening.
Yeah.
It definitely is in the West. I don't know. Have you had, obviously neither of us here are Catholic, so I'm not really sure what insight either of us can give. I don't know, but it's one of those things where I'm not sure if the Catholic population, how it feels about this new pope, about his new attitude.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of at a loss for words, which is rare, but just because I don't know anything about how Catholics feel as being I'm not a Catholic. I saw the Pope's ordination. I think it's very interesting how he's chosen, how he's elected. But other than that, again, all right, let's move on.
Mm.
In other China news, Chen Guangcheng, a blind Chinese human rights activist who a year ago bravely escaped house arrest to emigrate to the United States, claims that his family is still being harassed by the Chinese government. Chen's story is absolutely incredible. After teaching himself law, he went to primary school at like 17. He got an education way late, and then he taught himself law using books, and you know, he also had friends that practiced law. He began to actively protest against the Chinese government's mistreatment of the lower classes, including negligence of the physically handicapped, considering he was blind, this really hit home for him,
mm-hmm.
and the refusal of the Chinese government to consistently abide by the rule of law. As he was not a democracy advocate, he was tolerated for a little bit. However, when he began to directly lambast the Communist Party for forcing abortions on the peasants in the town of Linyi, which is a small town of about 10 million, a small town in China, about 10 million, in order to meet population quotas, he became increasingly targeted. Nicknamed the Barefoot Lawyer because he champions kind of the peasant cause, Chen was convicted to 3 years and 4 months in prison for charges of organizing a mob and destroying public property. Many domestic and international legal experts cited insufficient evidence and the corruption of local officials as delegitimizing factors in the case, but the charges were nonetheless upheld by multiple courts. A move viewed by some as epitomizing the inherent injustice and arbitrariness of the Chinese judicial system. Chen's lawyer tried to obtain parole for medical reasons, Chen is legally blind, but was refused. After being released in 2010, Chen was promptly put under extra legal house arrest, that is house arrest that was not sanctioned or ordered by any judiciary institution, in a small province out of sight and, the Chinese government hoped, out of mind.
During his house arrest, many people came to visit him. Most importantly, Batman actor Christian Bale attempted to bypass the guards surrounding Chen's home, and the ensuing scuffle was captured by a CNN crew. However, Chen did not complacently accept his punishment. Almost a year ago, in April of 2012, he escaped house arrest by bypassing the plainclothes guards that surrounded his home and sought refuge in the American embassy in Beijing for 6 days. During his escape, he badly injured his foot, and with the guarantee by the Chinese government that he would not be harmed, he was released by the Americans and into hospital care. During his convalescence, he expressed conflicting desires. At times he wished to stay in China, and at other times he desired asylum in the United States. Finally, a month after his escape, he flew with his wife and children to New York and settled into life in the States. However, Chen soon expressed concerns over the family he had left in China and the harassment they endured by the Chinese government. He continues to echo these concerns with increased fervency in the past few weeks.
You should really see that video. It's quite funny. You have Christian Bale scuffling with one of the guards outside Chen's home. Because he tried.
Really?
Yeah, it's captured on CNN. You can see it on YouTube. Because he tried to go visit. A lot of people try to go visit this, advocate for human rights in China.
Yeah.
And they weren't allowed because the Chinese government kept him under strict, even though, albeit like extra legal care. And you see Christian Bale scuffling with one of these guys. It's quite funny. But I mean, I guess it shows that regardless of what the Chinese government tries to do, now, especially with the internet and with, you know, 24-hour news cycles, you can't keep these kind of people out of mind.
No, yeah.
You know? Like that, the Democratic activist in Myanmar.
Oh, yeah. You know? Aung San Suu Kyi.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it used to be, I suppose, a while ago, maybe, you know, a few decades ago, that if you kept someone out of actively protesting and inciting rebellion, people would forget, it wouldn't happen. But now that you have all these different ways to contact people, I think it's quite interesting. And it also means that there is some kind of universal norm guiding people in their perception of what is right and what is wrong. Kind of contradicts everything about realism that we learned in IR. Anyway, here's a song.
Yep.
Okay, and we're back with some more China, because China's a really big country, so there's a lot to say about it. Anyway, here's something you probably didn't know, or if you did, well, let us tell you more about it. China, though a determinately single-party state, has some fake democratic parties. 8 so-called democratic parties, including the creatively named China Democratic League and China Association for Promoting Democracy, gather annually in a conference that ostensibly serves to facilitate intra-party communication, but really only reinforces the dominance of the Communist Party. These eight other parties obsequiously defer to the Communist Party, praising its achievements in governing China. They have no say in foreign or domestic policy and serve largely ceremonial roles, hosting dinner parties and raising money for colleges and odd social programs like improving ophthalmological care for the residents of Western China.
These parties are sly attempts by the Chinese government to co-opt media for opposition while simultaneously contesting accusations by the West that it is a single-party dictatorship. Educated urban Chinese elite who are inclined to criticize the government can do so benignly by joining one of these democratic parties, which are often at least partially staffed by members of the Communist Party bureaucracy.
The one real party, the Chinese Communist Party, is now newly headed by Xi Jinping. I think he came into office yesterday, mm-hmm. on Thursday. He was chosen personally by Hu Jintao, China's former president, as his successor. Jinping is advocating a close relationship with to the public, but without allowing the latter to participate in government, a kind of benevolent paternalism, enlightened dictatorship, or neo-authoritarianism. 4 months ago, he was appointed Communist Party General Secretary and Chairman of the Central Military Commission. Now, having been officially declared president, he rules over the three, I guess, dominating institutions in China, the party, the army, and the state. Jinping staunchly defends top-down leadership and is resistant to Western-style political liberalization.
However, his ambition to eradicate corruption and improve social and environmental conditions can only be achieved through political reform, many claim. In order to stem the flow of popular discontent and continue feeding China's burgeoning economy, political analysts highlight the need for Jinping to allow more input for the public than have his predecessors.
But, I mean, like, what do you think? I mean, do you think that economic reform, because so far it's been kind of like, you know, two Chinas. You know, you have the one side that they are completely economically liberalized and, you know, Hong Kong is this cosmopolitan, you know, trade center, port city. And then you have mm-hmm. complete autocratic communist rule, people disappearing for no reason with no explanation, kind of don't follow the rule of law. Do you think that it can continue like this, that, you know, the economics and the politics move on two separate and yet parallel dimensions?
I think it's working so far, so who's to say that it's not going to continue? But at the same time, I think people are getting more discontent with the autocratic regime. So I think eventually, at a certain point, it could blow up. But I mean, also, I guess if people are happy with the economy, I'm not sure they'll be as they'll need to protest as much.
Mm. There's even like in you know, studying for IR, just there's this one of these theories. I'm not really sure the specific name, but it's called like consumer desublimation or something like that. And it's basically considering the fact that right now, even in democracies, political decisions by the public and political participation is limited. However, people aren't discontent because the decrease in choices of about political, you know, foreign policy and domestic policy is counterweighted, I guess, by an increase in consumer choices. So it's like, yeah, okay, I don't really have a say in zoning laws or in how much I pay in taxes, but there are four different kinds of Pop-Tarts. So you kind of trade in one choice for another. It's actually a very interesting theory that people don't actually mind not having that much of a say in government if their immediate needs and their immediate in their immediate world, it appears that they have choice. Mm. Oh, I think it's very interesting. Anyway, do you want to play a song or just move on to the news story?
No, we can play a song.
Okay.
We are going to play...
What are we
going to
play?
Sorry, just 1 second.
Okay, and we're back. Just a quick shout out to devoted listener Louisa on the Buzzbox. She gave us a nice phrase for what we just talked about earlier, the desublimation, called feudalization of the bourgeoisie, which is interesting. It's a Marxist phrase, I think. Anyway, so back to, well, kind of the transition between China right now and another country. So whether Xi Jinping takes the advice of the political analysts and liberalizes the social and political system or not, we don't know. Now, moving on to a rather contentious country in Asia. On Monday, the government of the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or as it's more commonly known, North Korea, said that they had nullified the 1953 armistice between it and South Korea, negotiated after the Korean War. This move was a display of North Korean disapproval and suspicion concerning the joint military exercise between South Korean and U.S. soldiers that began on March 1st. Though there has been no fighting along the border between North and South Korea, the North Korean military has also begun to drill vigorously. And the government of the DPRK has issued multiple statements denouncing the new president of South Korea, Park Geun-hye. Park is the daughter of former Cold War dictator of South Korea, Park Chung-hee, who was assassinated 33 years ago. She has repeatedly urged North Korea to abandon its nuclear weapons program, which it refuses to do because it insists that nuclear weapons are a safeguard against the malicious, imperialistic United States.
Park wants reconciliation between the two nations, but North Korea has been increasingly aggressive in the past weeks after both Washington and the UN imposed harsh sanctions followed its third bungled nuclear test on February 12th of this year. In response, North Korea has openly criticized Park Geun-hye and cut the Red Cross hotline that existed between North and South Korea. Other lines of communication between the two neighboring countries are still open, however. In the latest news, North Korea has accused the U.S. and its allies of attacks on its internet servers amid tension on the peninsula. The Korean Central News Agency, the KCNA, said the intensive and persistent attacks coincided with the U.S.-South Korea military drills. Tensions originally escalated in the wake of North Korea's third nuclear test last month.
The test led to the aforementioned UN sanctions being imposed on Pyongyang, which has responded with strong rhetoric, both to the UN move and the annual joint drills, which it bitterly opposes. The two Koreas remain technically at war because the 1950-53 conflict ended in an armistice, not a treaty. South Korea says North Korea cannot unilaterally dissolve the armistice and has called on Pyongyang to tone down its language. North Korea, however, called the cyber attack a cowardly and despicable act.
North Korea has itself been blamed for spreading malicious software that crashed the websites of government agencies and businesses, and for a cyber attack on a South Korean state-run bank server in 2011 that took more than a week to fix. North Korea denies cyber attacks and accuses the South of a conspiracy to fuel confrontation, although defectors from the North have said that Pyongyang is recruiting thousands of computer engineers to its cyber warfare unit.
Military experts have said cyber warfare is a major threat for North Korea, along with its conventional forces and its weapons of mass destruction program, posing a security risk to utilities and communication networks in the South. North Korea has been accused of jamming global positioning system signals, affecting hundreds of flights at South Korea's main airport. U.S. spy agencies said this week for the first time that cyber attacks and cyber espionage had supplanted terrorism as the top security threat facing the U.S.
It's nobody's secret that the U.S. and South Korean puppet regime are massively bolstering up cyber forces in a bid to intensify the subversive activities and sabotages against the North Korea, KCNA said. Accusations of cyber attacks on the peninsula usually flow in the opposite direction, said the BBC's Lucy Williamson in Seoul. The South Korean intelligence sources say North Korea routinely attempts to access the network here, and Pyongyang is believed to have broken into Defense Ministry data at least once in the past few years. Nevertheless, the cause of the disruption remains unclear.
Current internet access in North Korea is extremely limited for locals, with most people only having access to a small number of state-run pages. The wider internet is available only to their own government and the military. Meanwhile, Washington and China are embroiled in their own row over hacking, with the U.S. President Barack Obama calling his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping to discuss the issue this week. What do you think? Is the internet? I mean, the internet is generally a good thing; allows you to get more information. But
yeah, sure.
Do you think cyber terrorism will really ever replace? I'm gonna say, you know, not legit, but like physical terrorism, I guess, more visceral.
I personally doubt it because
me too.
Well, I mean, I guess there's a lot more damage you can do over the internet than.
Yeah, but the problem is that a lot of times with terrorists, what they want is the reaction. They want kind of a to scare people.
But you would get the same kind. You could get a similar reaction, let's say, if, like, the WikiLeaks, there was a huge reaction.
I don't know, but it's like, would you get. But does it really cause a panic? It's one of those things.
No, it wouldn't cause a panic.
But that's. Well, you think, I guess, I don't know. I mean, I'm going on, you know, the most prominent, you know, the biggest terrorist attack, I guess, in my mind, considering, is probably 9/11.
I think 2001. Most people would agree with that.
And I'm comparing that to maybe perhaps if, I don't know, they had taken down a few servers in the United States, let's say, instead. had the internet existed back then, I really don't think that it would have been as monumental. So I don't know. I mean, there is the fact that the internet could do a lot of damage. I mean, we know that the group Anonymous, in its defense of Julian Assange. Okay. Anyway.
We have some extra members in the studio.
Yeah, my parents are here. But yeah, so one of the extra members has said that big damage can be caused if nuclear power plants, which are now controlled by, you know, electricity and I guess the internet things, are being shut down or tampered with, then yes, that could cause damage. But oh my God, I don't know. It's just okay, yeah, sure. I'm just everyone, we're getting ready for spring break. We're all less articulate. Yeah. Well, I'm less articulate. Anyway.
And on that note, we should play a song.
You wanna play another song? Yeah, let's do the song.
Okay, so now we move on to India, and there has been a recent uproar in India's parliament over Pakistan's parliament resolution condemning last month's hanging of Afzal Guru, a Kashmiri man. MPs from the main opposition BJP party said India must stop dialogue with Pakistan in protest. Guru was sentenced to death for the 2001 attack on India's parliament. This is when two people went into the parliament and they shot five people. And his hanging has seen days of angry protest in Indian-administered Kashmir.
Yeah, Pakistan's resolution also called for handing over Guru's body to his family. The resolution comes at a time when relations between India and Pakistan have been on a downward spiral. India's blamed Wednesday's deadly militant attack on a security force camp in Kashmir on Pakistan-based militants, a charge that Islamabad has vehemently denied. Five Indian troops were killed in the gun and grenade attack. Both the attackers were also killed.
On Friday, the leader of the opposition in the Raya Sabha, the upper house of parliament, Arun Jaitley, said that the government must reconsider its engagement with Pakistan after Thursday's resolution. Besides interfering in India's internal affairs, the resolution is an official statement by the entire policy of Pakistan endorsing the terrorist attacks, Mr. Jaitley said. India always suspected that Pakistan was behind the 2001 parliament attack, he said, and added that the resolution seems to have confirmed our fears. It is an official stamp of approval to one of the worst terrorist attacks, he said. The government of India will have to seriously consider how to deal with Pakistan. As long as this resolution remains, we should seriously forget normalizing ties.
The December 2001 attack was one of the most controversial incidents in recent Indian history, correspondents say. Five rebels stormed India's parliament in Delhi on the 13th of December in 2001, killing a gardener and eight policemen before they were shot dead by security forces. India blamed the attack on the Jaish-e-Mohammed militant group, which it said was backed by Pakistan. Pakistan denied involvement in the attack, but relations between the two countries nosedived as their armies massed about a million troops along the border in preparation for a fight.
India-Pakistan relations have always been tense at best, but such open hostility is not a good sign for the long-term potential of being peaceful neighbours. This has also coincided with the recent conflicts that are occurring in Kashmir. Police have reported that they have arrested a man in connection with Wednesday's gun and grenade attack in Srinagar, in which five security personnel were killed. Media reports, quoting police sources, say that a man was a resident of Pakistan, and India has said that two gunmen killed in the attack appeared not local but from across the border, a reference to Pakistan again.
Pakistan has, of course, rejected the accusation, calling it counterproductive. Reports quoting police sources said that diaries, an Indian SIM card, a tube of ointment made in Pakistan, and papers had been seized from the man, reportedly from Multan in Pakistan. India's Home Minister Sushil Kumar Shinde said in Parliament on Thursday that the two militants killed in Wednesday's attack appeared to be of Pakistani origin, and the diaries recovered from them contained Pakistani phone numbers. Pakistan had said it condemned such actions of terrorism in the strongest possible terms and calls upon the government of India to carry out a thorough investigation before leveling such accusations, which are counterproductive and serve no purpose.
A curfew was imposed in Srinagar following a day of violence on Wednesday, in which eight people were killed. Militants killed five security personnel, and the curfew was imposed after another man was killed later in the day in clashes between police and protesters. Indian-administered Kashmir has seen an insurgency against Indian rule since 1989, but the violence has declined for recent years.
Let's talk about this for a minute. I honestly do not know much about the Indian-Pakistani conflict except for the fact that they have been fighting over Kashmir for what seems like ages.
A long time, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, essentially there's a dispute over where the borders are. So Kashmir is a very, it's quite a resource-filled area. So it's quite, I guess, lucrative in that sense. And as a result, Pakistan, well, of course I'm not impartial because I'm Indian. But anyways, I always thought that the border included Kashmir for India, but they would like to disagree. And therefore, this has been going on for a while now. And I think it's now almost turned into a pride thing, whichever country's almost better.
Can't just split it down the middle. It's not really viable.
I guess that's not the...
I don't know. I mean, like, honestly, I know for a fact that territorial disputes are super, super hard to, you know, to contest and to solve. I mean, God knows that there's been one in the Middle East now, and there's one right now.
And also another thing is that Kashmir, I think, is majority of the people there are Muslim in Kashmir as well. So Pakistan's saying that considering when we parted, we were trying to make a Muslim nation, surely Kashmir would therefore be part of Pakistan as well.
Pakistan.
Yeah, exactly.
However, I mean, would do enough people live in Kashmir and identify themselves as Kashmirian? I mean, would it be possible for it to become an independent state?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they would want that.
And would it be possible for them to have a referendum? Because, I mean, while, yes, maybe they are Muslim and so they identify religiously more with Pakistan, India, I think, is far more successful as a country and has had more economic success in recent years.
No, and it's not as if Kashmir is the only place in India where there are Muslims. There are Muslims all over India still. And it's not really a big deal. But I think that's just one of the arguments that they have as to why they deserve Kashmir. But
I don't know.
I don't think it's going to get resolved.
You don't think it's going to be resolved soon? You think it's going to be one of those?
Well, I mean,
historically,
the thing is now it's kind of, they've got mutually assured destruction. So
both,
but India obviously doesn't want to use it, but Pakistan, by their actions, it seems more inclined
available. To resort to the most, you know, extreme kind of means. I don't know. I think that really what would finally... I really just think Pakistan needs to stabilize politically a little bit first and stop harboring terrorists.
Well, it says it doesn't.
So. Yeah, okay. It also said it wasn't hiding Osama bin Laden, but...
Anyways, that wasn't true.
Anyway, we need to move on because we're running out of time. So, move on to Nepal for our final story of the hour.
Yeah.
Nepal has now sworn in their newest interim government. The chief judge of Nepal's Supreme Court has been sworn in to lead a new interim government charged with holding elections in 3 months. Cross-party agreement on the appointment of Kilraj Regmi has brought an end to an impasse, before the four main political parties. They had been at loggerheads over the issue since the last parliament's term expired almost a year ago. The deal aims to give Nepal a neutral government to oversee elections.
There has been an ongoing mistrust both within and between the political parties, resulting in Nepal being unable to implement a peace deal signed 6 years ago to end a decade-long civil war. It is now hoped that elections in June will lead to the writing of a new constitution and help ensure lasting peace.
Mr. Regmi will set aside his court duties to take on his new role, but will return as Chief Justice when his tenure leading the government ends. His title is chairman of the interim election government. The priority and the main task of this government is to hold elections, he said. I urge all the citizens and political parties to cooperate in the process so that we can complete the task soon. Nepal's last parliament was elected in 2008. Its term of office expired in May 2012 before it succeeded in its mission to draft a new constitution.
Regmi is the first Chief Justice to lead a government in Nepal's history. His appointment, after a night of hard negotiations, brings months of political uncertainty to an end. It also raises hopes that Nepal can finally achieve some sort of political stability after the June vote. Regmi says that between now and then, his focus will be on ensuring no strong links to major parties. His main challenge will be to get all of them, especially those opposed to his appointment, on board and ensure that Nepal's democracy survives untarnished. This is a difficult task at the best of times, but he does have some room for manoeuvres. Under the terms of Wednesday's deal, he has the option of delaying it until November.
Nepal's last parliament was elected in 2008. Its term of office expired in May before it succeeded in its mission, and it has drafted a new constitution. The leader of the Unified Communist Party of Nepal, he's Maoist, Baburam Bhattarai, has been head of a caretaker administration since then, despite opposition from parties who did not want him in office, while elections for a new constituent assembly were held. The disagreement meant that elections scheduled for November 2012 were cancelled. Correspondents say Mr. Regney, 63, had been free of controversy in his 2 years as Chief Justice. But the Nepal Bar Association and some smaller political parties have been critical of the judiciary being drawn into politics.
This marks a promising new phase for Nepalese politics. And on that note, we have to end the show. So thank you all for listening this semester.
See you guys after the break. Yeah. We'll be happy to be back. Everyone have a great vacation.